And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am tremendously excited about today's program. From time to time, I have the honor and pleasure of speaking with medical doctors, although that pleasure is not mine all that often. And I appreciate it whenever a busy medical doctor is willing to make time in their busy life and schedule to have a conversation. In this case, it is going to be a conversation about an absolutely remarkable book called Tornado of Life, A Doctor's Journey Through Constraints and Creativity in the ER. The author of this book is Dr. Jay Baruch, who is a professor of emergency medicine at Alpert Medical School at Brown University. And in this memoir, Dr. Baruch recounts all kinds of extraordinary, as well as a few, if you want to call them, ordinary experiences that he has had over the years as a physician in emergency medicine. And it's a beautifully written book, intriguingly organized to touch on so many different facets of life in the ER. And it is a book, of course, written from his own perspective, but he does, I think, a remarkable job of putting us in the place of the patient. And that in it of itself is a great achievement. And I think Dr. Baruch clearly has given long and profound thought to what it means to be a patient in an ER and the ways in which care is given to them effectively and sometimes ineffectively. He has learned many, many lessons along the way and written about them so well in this book, again, titled Tornado of Life, A Doctor's Journey Through Constraints and Creativity in the ER, published by MIT Press. Dr. Jay Baruch, we welcome you to the morning show.
Oh, man, this is wonderful. Thank you so much. It's really great to be here, Greg. I'm honored to be here.
I'm really, really pleased to be speaking with you. I want to touch on something that actually comes up way towards the end of the book in the 40th chapter, which is titled Writing Stories of Medicine. And the whole business of story is a predominant theme in this book. And in this, if I read correctly, it sounds like you have done a fair amount of fiction writing in your life. But this, of course, is very much a work of nonfiction. And at this point in the
That's
chapter,
right.
You say, the leap into nonfiction required faithfulness to reality, a tether to actual people, and part of the process of leaving those skills for this new form of writing also meant confronting my dual and dueling roles as a physician and writer. I wonder if you could just expand on those intriguing words about what this writing venture felt like for you versus earlier writing that you did, which was fictional. What kinds of things did you have to sort of consider, weigh, juggle in doing this?
Yeah, that's such a critical question, Greg, and I'm glad you're bringing that up early in our conversation, because it was really a central concern for my actually throughout my career. So, you know, in this particular book, you know, realizing that I was writing about real situations, I can't do that without recognizing a couple of fundamental tensions that were at work and at play. One is that, you know, patients come to the ER for me to help them, right? They're not there to be subjects of a story for my writing. And I have to be listening to patients not as a writer, but as a physician. I got to be thinking solely and entirely, primarily of them, you know, trying to respect their privacy and their confidentiality and to put their concerns and their needs first. And so as I write, the reason why I actually wrote a short chapter and made it actually part of the book is because I didn't want it to just sort of be a disclaimer in fine print that beginning of a book or at the end of the book. I want it to actually be part of the conversation, because I think these stories needed to be, they were largely about me and my own troubles and my own struggles and my own failings, and also how I think the healthcare system and the framing of what is considered a valid healthcare problem is often ignored or looked at in a lens that does not promote a satisfactory sense of being heard by patients. And in order to do that, in order to sort of be real in the sense that this is happening in my practice, I had to straddle my obligations to patients and my obligations to the faithfulness of the stories I wanted to tell. And then I articulated in that chapter how I went about it. I was very honest, very forthcoming about it. And when I write, I write all the time, and it's usually for myself. I'm not writing to be published necessarily. I'm writing for myself. Writing serves as a way for me to sort through complicated and challenging situations that perhaps I don't have the time or I don't have the wherewithal in the busy day. And it allows me to actually a sense of control, because by putting words to the page, you sometimes see things you didn't see otherwise. You get very granular when you start writing sentences. Your mind goes into different directions, and I just find I think differently when I'm writing. Hmm. And what happened with this book is that there were certain situations that when there were enough situations or enough moments that were similar that seemed to resonate, or there were certain challenges that I was facing that seemed to fit a pattern, that I decided, maybe this is going to be something I'm going to end up writing about. And so, as I write in that particular essay, I feel that I think there are probably 5 or 10 or 20 people who might say, this is what happened to me, but most likely it isn't. And so I'm trying to be sensitive to the tensions of my responsibility as a physician, as well as my responsibility as a writer. And in the chapter, I discuss the ethics of narrative writing, and we have to acknowledge our responsibility, whether you're a physician or whether you're just a journalist, without having other ethical responsibilities towards your subjects, there still is this ethical tension and this sense of ethical accountability to the people that you're writing about. And I love, I quote the journalist, the wonderful journalist and novelist and the nonfiction writer Isabel Wilkinson, and a talk she gave, and she said that narrative writers must strike a careful balance, caring about our subjects without sacrificing our narratives, while caring about our narratives without sacrificing our subjects. Good journalism and empathy can go hand in hand. And so I feel like I wrote each of these pieces with the sense of, of trying to uphold the trust of the people I'm writing about. And I closed the piece about with a respectful nod to the importance of the imagination and the importance of the imagination in being a morally responsible and accountable physician writer. And I say something to the effect of, I pretend that the patient is looking over my shoulder as I write. And would they consider the writing fair, thoughtful, responsible, the best it could be? And would they still respect me as a physician? And so that's, I try to allow myself a really high bar. I mean, each of these pieces took years, many of them years and years and years. They happened years and years ago. They've been rewritten 20, 30 times to try to make certain that they could be the best they could be, that I've taken out whatever I need to take out that I kept in whatever was really vital. And so I had to become very, very precise and how I approached my writing in this situation. My fiction was went the other direction. My fiction went outward. My fiction was like I might start in a particular situation, and some of my fiction involved medical situations, but I went into this other place. You know, I said that was the start of it, and then I let my imagination run wild. And oftentimes, what was the inciting and beginning of a piece in the rewrites was scrubbed entirely clean, and what began as something that was remotely medical ended up being nothing about it, or it was just a side story. So I really blew out and entered the world of what if this happened with my fiction. When my nonfiction, I became very narrow and saying, okay, how do I really unpack the many different angles in this situation? How do I look at it from many different perspectives? How do I look at the dark sides of myself, which I interrogate pretty honestly and I hopefully transparently in the book? And so I felt like, for me, the metaphor was going in two different directions, where I was getting very narrow and very rich and very deep in my nonfiction in these small moments. And though I tried to really be just as precise in my fiction, the fiction was going into this what-if territory and really going into some wild other places that often led me further and further away from what I initially was intending to write about. And that was part of the fascination.
Yeah, I love that. Back to that 40th chapter, a paragraph in which you talk about that tension. You write, "As a physician writer, my first allegiance is to patients and to the moral pillar of trust. Their trust is precious, especially when I'm writing narratives based on clinical experiences where I'm a subject too. I could have written in abstract or theoretical terms, but it would lose specificity, immediacy, and urgency. It would cease to be a narrative. My duty as a writer is to be sensitive to this tension, heed its pull, and be as responsible as possible." For those of you just joining us, I am speaking with Dr. Jay Baruch about his book, Tornado of Life, A Doctor's Journey Through the Constraints and Creativity in the ER. One thing you say about the book early on is that you had an original plan, I think, if I understand correctly, for the book to be kind of what might have seemed like a crazy jumble. You write at one point, "The practice of emergency medicine is a dance with the unexpected. I wanted to simulate that instability." Do I understand that you took that initial model and ultimately discarded it? And if so, then describe the model which replaced it.
Well, I'm glad that you feel like, I'm assuming, maybe I'm making a wrong assumption, Greg, that you feel like there's some stability to the book.
I do.
Thank you. No, it wasn't anymore. This was our initial plan, which was, and I have to give huge thanks to my editor, Bob Pryor at MIT Press, because when, you know, I think people expect, like a lot of physician books, beautiful, wonderful physician narratives are oftentimes told not in this way. They're more, I think that people come into a book expecting a certain type of book from a physician narrative about written by physicians. And this is very different. I mean, I'm actually, you know, I think it gets labeled as a memoir, but if it's anything, it's a memoir of my own insecurities and thinking. It's not really a memoir of my life, though there's some a couple of personal essays in there. And so what we were trying to do is trying to not just write about experiences, but to actually take patients and take readers into the experience so they can actually not just read about what I'm talking about. I've been doing this for 30 years, but, you know, and I know I'm probably an expert in some regards, but I'm also a work in progress. after 30 years, like the more you know, the more you realize you don't know. And especially in the world of emergency medicine, like rarely does an ER shift go by when I'm not encountering something that I've never seen before, or I'm not encountering a part of myself that I've never recognized before. I mean, it's really, I can't imagine my own development as a human being without the challenges and the constraints of just practicing emergency medicine on a regular basis for 30 years. So I wanted to replicate that. And so there's not a lot of sort of tidy narratives and lessons necessarily saying, this is what you should learn from this. It's actually facing the stories that we all experience in our lives, like these small, what might seem like small moments or anything but small to those of us who are experiencing them. And a lot of people come to the emergency department for troubles and needs that are not just, you know, that's not necessarily what you see on TV, right? Which people think is like, this is what emergency medicine is, someone coding or there's a bad trauma. What's difficult about these quieter moments is that it's really gets at the suffering that so many people are experiencing in their daily lives and how hard it is to articulate those stories. And oftentimes I find that when patients are really unhappy or dissatisfied with the care that they get from the healthcare system, it's even when what was done was standard of care, quote unquote, it's the fact they don't feel like the physicians heard them, or they felt they had deeper needs that were not necessarily addressed. And there's actually literature that shows that, you know, that patients oftentimes want their doctors to ask questions. You know, we don't always have to have the answers when there aren't answers. Sometimes what they want from us is to actually be curious and to ask questions of their lives. And that's not a lot to ask for. And oftentimes that's really the very thing that we must be doing, which is trying to give legitimacy to patients' experiences, their complicated experiences, and not shying away from that.
Mm. One of the things you talk about at length in the second chapter of the book is about how so much of emergency medicine is, as I said earlier, you call it a dance with the unexpected, and that often it is about improvisation. It is a fundamentally creative act. The medical encounter has been compared to improvisation, unscripted and unpredictable. It involves curiosity and being open to other possibilities rather than closing them off. It actually really surprised me to see you write about that, because I think a lot of us have heard about the phenomena about how the ER is often full of people who are just showing up with the sniffles, or maybe something a little more serious, but showing up with things that are truly not emergencies and certainly not the things that we tend to watch on a show like ER or Grey's Anatomy or whatever. And I kind of, I guess, leapt to the assumption that there is much more tedium in the ER, and that punctuated by the occasional moments that are truly striking and original, it really looks like I'm wrong about that. That in fact, this is a remarkable place to work, even if many of the situations you confront are maybe not emergencies in the purest sense of the word. Can you just talk about that sort of lay of the land in at least the ER in which you have worked?
I get it. Like I don't think you're wrong. I don't think it's just that it's more layered and it's more complicated, right? And I have to tell you, like, I get frustrated sometimes when, you know, you sit there and you go, God, you know, why are you here for the sniffles, right? And oftentimes it's not necessarily the sniffles. You know, sometimes there's a lot of assumptions embedded into it's just the sniffles. There's the what do you think the sniffles really mean? Do you have a doctor? Did you try calling your doctor? Did the doctor actually call back and call back after you left the message? Is there work-related issues? Or do you have, is someone else sick at home with something that's really serious that began as the sniffles and you worried the sniffles might be X, Y, and Z, i.e. COVID, for example? What I talk about in the book is this idea that, you know, that, you know, let's face it, Greg, like none of us want to go to the ER. Like, right? Like you go there and, you know, you invariably will wait for X amount of time and you're going to be seen by someone who you've never seen before. Maybe you have, but most of the time we don't know who you're going to be seen by. And so every visit to the emergency department is usually, and I consider this a narrative event. Like it's an event, it's a high point in your story. Like why did you leave your day? Why did you leave your job? Why did you leave your family? Why did you leave that good night's sleep? Or maybe it was a bad night's sleep to come to the ER. Right. And so, you know, an example that I actually did not write about in the book that sort of comes to mind, and this is a place, you know, again, it sort of highlights my own embarrassment and some of the approaches I've had towards patients over the years. But, you know, years and years ago, I was caring for someone. I was in a different part of the country who it was the middle of the night. Like we weren't all that busy. It was those times when actually we even at overnight, you might not be so busy. We weren't that busy. And a young kid, you know, in his early 20s came in with the sniffles. Like, it was, you know, and I'm asking about his sniffles and his appetite's lousy and he hasn't been sleeping. And it's like all this vague symptoms that one might think is like a cold. And so this, you know, the nursing staff is like, guy, why is he here? Like he waited for, you know, why is he waiting? Why did he come here just for this? And about to pass judgment. And we were all like a little bit frustrated because he wasn't very forthcoming with the history. And then I noticed that his accent was a little bit different. And I asked him where he was from. And then the story came out, the fact that, you know, that he came from a family out west that was sort of a very masculine culture, and he was coming out of the closet. He told his family, and they did not respond well, and he left, and he was homeless. And this was his first night in this new town where I was working in the ER, and he hadn't slept because he's been on the road. He's been homeless. He's not used to being homeless. He hasn't eaten because he had no food. He didn't have money for food. And so, you know, did he have anything medically wrong with him? No. But did he have something that, was he distressed in a way that was incredibly meaningful? Yes.
He needed, you know, help.
And we were able to talk. He needed help, right? He needed a different type of help. Even if it was just a place to sleep and a place to talk to someone about what he was going through and to strategize and to think out loud. So in the end, I'm not saying that our ERs aren't sometimes filled with people who definitely don't have what we think is an acute emergency, but I think we have to approach every patient with the mindset that it's an emergency to them.
Mm.
Right. Like, well, it's an emergency to them. So what is that? And at all times, those are like the easiest ones. Because sometimes it's, if you just ask the right questions, you say, God, what concerns you? Well, I'm worried about it's X. Okay. Well, you know what? We can easily, let's say you worry about it's COVID. We can do a COVID test. Or I don't think it is COVID, but this is what we can do. We can test for you, and this is what your next steps are. And so, you know, the idea about a chief complaint pointing to an identical diagnosis sometimes causes us to belittle the things that don't seem like an emergency. But if we think about like a patient's presentation as something that is troubling for them and that they have a chief need, and do we ask those types of questions, oftentimes those can be incredibly rewarding, not just for patients, but for us too, because we feel like we've done something.
Hmm. And of course, much of that is a matter of communicating, and of communicating well and of listening well. And at one point in the second chapter, you say to be an emergency doctor is to be a professional listener of sorts, and making sure that you really understand the sometimes tangled stories that your patients are bringing with them. We're talking about the memoir Tornado of Life, A Doctor's Journey Through Constraints and Creativity in the ER, talking with its author, Dr. Jay Baruch. It is not until the third chapter of the book, in the section of the book which is titled Vulnerability, that we learn why your book is titled Tornado of Life. And that is because of something shared with you by a patient named Cheryl, who came into the ER. We don't have time to thoroughly tell her story, but let's at least touch on the matter of her tornado of life.
Yeah, she was someone who came in the middle of the night. She was, again, like a complicated story. She was brought in from a local shelter because she was acting out. And she was making she was being somewhat vocal in the emergency department and was asking for, to be seen by a doctor, and the nurse came and I came. And then when I came to talk to her, she was, she sort of, stopped talking. And she was someone who had sort of layers of problems and a whole like litany of just bad things that were happening, like, and this happened, and this happened, and this happened, and it was some mental health problems, and some substance use problems, and some relationship, a death of a loved one, a gesture of self-harm, and when I finally was able to sort of sit with her, and she started talking, she said, I'm stuck in a tornado of life, and the element, what was so key about that experience to me, which happened years and years ago, was that I sort of made the connection between my work in writing and my work in humanities. I direct the humanities and bioethics scholarly concentration at the Medical School of Brown, and I've been heavily involved with ethics and humanities for many, many years. And there's a sociologist and a narrative scholar named Arthur Frank who wrote the seminal book called The Wounded Storyteller, which was really one of my entry points into this world of humanities in medicine 20, 25 years ago. And it's in the book, he touches upon three sort of framing narratives that operate in medicine. And it's an incredible book, and I recommend to anybody to read it. His name is Arthur Frank, and it's The Wounded Storyteller. And there's three narratives are like a restitution narrative, a quest narrative, and a chaos narrative. And briefly, just to fill in your listeners, the restitution narrative is, I think is our standard narrative in like a story arc in medicine. And I think, and I write about how it's akin to the commercial of the medic, cold commercial you see on television, like you were well, and then you became sick and you took the purple pill or the green pill or whatever. And then you're better. You're back to who you once were. Right. And you're in they cut to the scene of you like laughing with a loved one, or you're kicking the ball in the park. And so you were well, then you became sick, and then you returned back to the land of the well. And then Arthur Frank describes the quest narratives, which build on the work of Joseph Campbell, and the idea of sort of illness is a journey. And Arthur Frank was a cancer survivor, which he writes about in his book. In a quest narrative, you're well until you become sick, for example, cancer. And then you get you're put on a journey. Your illness, your sickness is on a journey, and you end up in this other place where you face challenges, you face trials, and you're tested in many ways. And if you're lucky, you have a chance to come back to the land of the well, but you're not the same person who you were when you left because of the experience. And you might have experienced things that are just so hard to put into words, even to those people who are closest to you, you know? And then there are the chaos narratives, which are those narratives which are, you know, sometimes it's like it's if a narrative is a way to sort of put order into experiences, chaotic experiences, chaos narratives are those narratives or those experiences that just defy any ordering. You can't put them in the word into words, and they can, and you can sometimes know that, like when you talk to somebody, and this happened, and this happened, and this happened, and then, and there's a sense of just troubles building and building and building, and they're just so hard to understand, and not just put into words, but it's hard to understand. And the biggest danger as providers, as health providers, is to try to give an answer and to try to provide a solution to stories and experiences that there aren't any easy answers to, because by not dignifying the chaos in someone's story, you're sort of not dignifying the storyteller.
Mm.
And sometimes what's required is for us to just sit there and listen and be respectful and give legitimacy to people's often very complicated experiences. And again, like these aren't like three strict categories. Like there's a blend. These things happen and there's overlap. He does not create this, you know, I'm totally, I'm not giving Arthur Frank's really beautiful articulation of these ideas justice, but and very briefly, those are the sort of the key points that I've taken away, and I've applied to my practice. Because you know, knowing that I'm listening to a chaos narrative, as I was listening with Cheryl, also enabled me to understand what my responsibilities were. Which was, yes, there was certain medical stuff I needed to deal with, but I also had a good framing for listening and trying to understand her experience and what would be a respectful response to her and her story.
Mm.
And it was one of those moments, Greg, where I really saw the connection between, you know, the importance of humanities and different types of thinking. And different types of scholarship and their absolute relevance to clinical care.
Mm. You know, one of the things you say when you talk about this situation with this patient named Cheryl and this painful chaos narrative that she was sharing with you is you really touch on one of the most challenging parts of being an emergency room physician in particular. You say, what do you say to someone caught up in the tornado of life whose problems are so woven into other problems that you are almost afraid to try to tug at a single thread for fear of everything unraveling? And you go on further to you know, kind of touch on this matter of not knowing the person in so many instances. In many instances, it is a complete stranger. And I think in contrast to that, of, for instance, my sister, who is a family physician, and one of the reasons she was drawn to that particular kind of medicine is because in some cases you are caring for a patient from cradle to grave, or at least for a long stretch of life's journey. And for you and your colleagues who are emergency room physicians, in a sense, you are not accorded that luxury. And I suppose that's often why there is this sense of improvisation and of responding in the moment, because there is sometimes no history whatsoever upon which you can draw, and no, I think you call it at one point, no bank of trust upon which you
right.
can draw in terms of establishing these connections with your patients and understanding exactly what they need.
Right. And I have to say that, you know, part of that, and it's hard, like but I feel that, like in medicine, we focus so much on being right and having an answer. And that's important. Like if you come in with, you know, chest pain, shortness of breath, weakness, you know, and I should be thinking about, let's say, for example, if there are situations that you're coming with a heart attack, I should diagnose a heart attack. You know, I should be thinking broadly about the many different ways that a heart attack or a heart, you know, problems can manifest itself, and really, you know, do the appropriate testing for that. There are certain things I have to be absolutely, you know, scrupulous and diligent about. But the thing is that when someone doesn't fit in neatly into a category, or their story doesn't fit neatly into a category, the default isn't, oh, it's nothing, or, you know, or slapping a diagnosis for the sake of slapping a diagnosis. What is required is at least an attempt to try to figure out what's going on, even if it's a non-medical problem, or even if it's just acknowledging just the challenges that people are experiencing, going through just every day. Like every day. I mean, the opening quote in the beginning of the section on vulnerability is one of my favorite from the Irish novelist Colin McCann, who I love from his novel Let the Great World Spin. When I say, and he writes, as the characters says, I sit here thinking how much courage it takes to live an ordinary life. And that's where the privilege of being an ER doc and even being a family doc is, you know, when you talk about your family, is the fact that, you know, we get a chance to see people and to engage and talk with people at, you know, living various different lives and trying to make it through their day. And as I write in the book, you know, each experience of illness is, you know, to quote the narrative scholar Catherine Montgomery, is uncharted territory. You know, and we have to be willing to go there. You know, there's a role for big data and to look at big research studies, and sometimes we need to look at like what happens with 10,000 patients to give advice on recommendations or what the next treatment or the next therapy or the right diagnostic instrument should be, but there are times that we have to get very small and we have to get very specific and have the tools to actually delve into people's individual stories and their experiences, and that's equally as important. It's not one or the other, it's actually both.
Absolutely. And of course, you write so persuasively about how the typical ER is sometimes not set up for that very well. I mean, and you have, for instance, I think you describe one point, rooms upon rooms upon rooms and filled with equipment and so on. But it is often a setting in which it is difficult to achieve that sense of compassion and intimacy and true comfort in the most profound sense of the word. I want to make sure that we have a chance for you to talk about an especially interesting chapter in the book, chapter 10, titled Upside Down. When you find yourself as a patient in an ER down in North Carolina, when you were there with your family, I think your teenage son was engaged in some kind of baseball event down there, but
right.
Some kind of chronic heart condition, in a sense, landed you in the ER, and hence the intriguing title, Upside Down, where you are seeing the ER from a very different perspective, not as the emergency room physician, but as a patient yourself. And you talk about how this was a situation in which you were fluent in the language of the ER. I mean, you understood all of the lingo and so on in a way that most of us couldn't possibly. And yet it was a profoundly disconcerting situation for you. And you obviously took away some important lessons. What do you think were the most lasting benefits for you as a physician to have been a patient in an ER?
Yeah, I have two essays. Yeah, I know. Thank you for bringing up that essay. I had a couple of moments where, you know, I had some heart issues. I had heart surgery. I went from being very healthy to being less than healthy when I was in my early 40s. And I write that particular essay is actually later on in the book. And the essay you refer to, this happened like several years later. And but from both experiences, what I found most interesting, Greg, is that first off, like people wanted to put me, like I couldn't just be a patient. I was a physician patient, meaning that like, was being a patient going to make you a better doctor? You know, what are you going to, and suddenly I felt like I was the subject of some large narrative. Like they wanted me to be a certain type of patient. And if anything in this, if there's anything in this book that I would love readers to sort of get out of is that, you know, we as a society have a tendency to try to like create like nice, cozy narratives with a good middle, what makes all good stories, right? Which is a good beginning, middle, and an ending. And this is what you learn at the end of it. And I resist, you know, and I guess part of it is like in emergency medicine, you sort of don't always have the luxury of having a convenient narrative that ends well, or even any kind of ending at all. And you sort of just, you bring people to a certain point. But I resisted that, and I felt like there was many things that I got out of being a patient, and there were a few things that maybe were less praiseworthy that I got out of being a patient. So, you know, I learned that about just waiting for information. Like when you're waiting, you have your mind goes into bizarre places, and there's a tension and anxiety in just waiting, whether it's waiting for, you know, a doctor or a nurse to show up, or just waiting for a test result to come back. I realized that those curtains that we use, that we think of as walls, really don't block any sounds, and you hear, and when you sit in there for hours with nothing to do, you hear everything. Like your hearing is never as acute. I also realized that, you know, that stretcher beds, like in our ERs, are the most uncomfortable things. And I'll joke around with patients and I say, you know what, if you do to come in with back problems, you're going to leave with back problems. And I also, you know, realized that, you know, when you're sick and you're at your most vulnerable, sometimes the hardest part of being sick is dealing with our healthcare system and trying to get in contact with doctors or trying to get in contact with pharmacists or insurance companies or whoever. And I find that I've been, you know, I'm more inclined to go the extra yard to try to line people up and make contact with people, because oftentimes patients can't get in contact with their doctors. They get like 14 voice different machine embodied things to do this, to press that number, to press this, and then they have to do it all over again, and that ends up being worse than actually being sick. So I tried to move that along. I also realized the value of nurses and staff. You know, when I was sick, the people who I have good doctors, I have wonderful doctors, the people who just comforted me, and not just provided physical comfort, but just made me feel cared for, were always my nurses, were like the CAT scan techs, like my physical therapists, like people who were, that were part of the healthcare team that don't get a fraction of the acknowledgement that they deserve, were the very people who I was just, you know, brought a smile to my face, that made me feel like I can do this, that made me feel cared for, listened to, and really often modeled what we all should be doing as caregivers. And the flip side of it is I oftentimes became a little bit more resistant to those patients who were, you know, less than understanding about a wait or very demanding. I became less tolerant of that from patients. It was complicated, but ultimately, like I'd like to say that in an ideal world, I come at these insights without ever having been sick. That's the best thing. I found that being destabilized, like being sick, destabilized me, Greg. There was a time there when I felt like I was sick, but I always thought that I was in control and I was going to get better. And then you reach an age, you know, when you get sick and you go, you know what, I might not be the person I once was because I'm no longer 20 or 30 anymore. And so I can't be that person anymore. And you just look at the world differently. You know, what you value, like what your sensitivities are, it gets modulated differently. And I wish I could be that person while also being younger. If someone could work on that technology or that pill, that would be wonderful. But unfortunately, I think you got to earn it.
Well, and of course, you are now in the business at Alpert Medical School of helping shape the emergency room physicians of tomorrow, and trying to impart upon them all that you have learned and all of the ways in which you yourself have grown as an emergency room physician, and of course, all of the lessons you still have to learn, as do anybody who find themselves in this challenging work. I want to just make sure our listeners understand that your book touches on all kinds of things that we had no time to explore, all kinds of things that gave me all kinds of things to think about, like a chapter called Pain, A Story That's Hard to Treat, in which you explore what someone has called the quintessentially private experience of what does somebody do when someone, when what do you do when a patient comes in complaining of terrible pain, and what is it that you can do to help them that is safe? You talk about the experience of that infernal waiting room in the typical ER, which you call at one point a first order oxymoron, that is waiting in an emergency room. And and of course about how you deliver sometimes brutally sorrowful news to someone, and what is it, how do you choose those words, what is it that you can do to be compassionate and gentle yet absolutely clear. I mean, we come away from this book, among other things, with a deeper appreciation of all that makes this kind of medicine so very, very challenging, and it makes us appreciate all the more those situations when we experience first-rate and compassionate care in an emergency room. It is something not to take for granted. The book, again, is Tornado of Life, A Doctor's Journey Through Constraints and Creativity in the ER, published by MIT Press, the author, Dr. Jay Baruch. Dr. Baruch, I really appreciate you making time in your schedule for this extensive conversation about your wonderful book. I hope many people will seek it out, read it, and enjoy it, and learn from it as I did. And thank you again. Best wishes to you and the good work you're doing.
Oh, thank you so much, Greg. I really, really appreciate it.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, a very special day and a bittersweet day. Tomorrow very likely will be the last Morning Show visit from Brian Albrecht, the president of Gateway Technical College, who a few months ago announced his retirement from the Gateway presidency. He is planning on tomorrow being his last Morning Show visit. And so we will be talking with him about his tenure as president and all of the ways in which Gateway has grown in spectacular ways over the last 16 years. And we'll find out a little bit about what he foresees as Gateway's future and his own future as well as he looks forward to retirement.